this is an extremely universally accepted story that seems to be a story that people tell over and over again because it has many parts to it, and there's a great deal of interest because it has to do with one of the great miracles of Jesus, the multiplication of the loaves and fishes. It's a story in the life of Jesus that we like to tell our children because it is very interesting. And I hope this morning we'll understand the Word of God and the truths of God's Word as God intended for us to do, and not simply look at this as some interesting story in the life of Jesus. Success is an elusive concept. And by that I mean there is the definition of all of the onlookers. People talk about your life, they talk about my life, but they never know what I am inside or what you are inside. So it's a different perspective. There is the definition of the individual. The crowd may think a man is successful while the man himself may consider himself to be an abject failure. And I think of a person who has built a tremendous empire and is fantastically wealthy. And all of the people look at him and say, this man is so successful, but the man himself, looking at himself and his life, looks at the life of his children, of his family, and sees that they have deteriorated, that they have forsaken the things that he believed in, and so in spite of all of the wealth that he possesses, he looks upon himself as a failure. Again, I say that the concept of success and failure is very elusive. In these verses, we see what the crowds would call a great success. Number one, there was a great multitude who sought the presence of Jesus and made tremendous efforts to come into his presence. Who can say that that's not a good thing? And then, of course, miracles had been done by Jesus. We see the things he'd done before this incident. We see now the multiplication of the loaves and the fishes. And according to the figures that are here in the Bible and not according to the figures of the Sunday school superintendent of how many they had in Sunday school, Sunday school superintendents through the years have been notoriously gracious to pastors in helping them reach their goals in Sunday school. I remember one fellow said they had their goal was 500, they had 499. The guy went out and looked around and finally saw a dog crossing a church property and went in and said, we had 500, so we reached our goal. But the figures that are reported here are in the Word of God. It says 5,000 men. We don't know how many other people there were, but evidently between 8,000 and 10,000 people, we don't know. But there were 5,000 men, and every one of these men who were there had come and they had gathered to see Jesus. You can't find fault with that, can you? Then, of course, thousands had been fed by him, and these quotation marks followers of Jesus sought to make him king. And here we are, 5,000 men who have been touched by the miracles of Jesus, and they want to make Jesus king. That seems to be the epitome of success. 5,000 men who have sacrificed to come to an isolated place, and they have found Jesus and they have seen what he can do. They have responded to what he has done, and they seek to capture him and make him king. There are probably millions of men today involved in religion who would say, now that's what I call success. They look like success. what did Jesus say about the whole circumstance? After all, we're going to have to judge this by what Jesus says and not by what men who live in the world today say. Well, the first disappointing thing is that Jesus declined their offer to be their king. He revealed their motive in verse 26 by saying, "You come because you did eat of the loaves and were filled." Just on the outward appearance, just according to what you would see with a human eye, you'd say these are devoted men who've come to do a great thing and who have been touched by the work of God, and now they want to make him king. But Jesus looked at their hearts and said, "You guys are looking for a free meal. You got another motive other than glorifying God." He identified their error and then hid from them. I'm serious. He went then and hid from them. Doesn't sound like success, does it? Didn't work, to be quite frank with you, the way that God intended for it to work. Now, as we look at verses 1 and 2, you can see a great multitude followed him. After these things, Jesus went over the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias, and a great multitude followed him because they saw his miracles, which he had done on them that were diseased. The word diseased here means the people that are sick in every category. People who are lame and people who are blind and people who have heart trouble. And Jesus healed all of these people. And these were more than miracles, they were signs. And the Bible tells us in verse 3 that Jesus went up into a mountain and there he sat with his disciples, no doubt teaching them about himself. And in verse 4, the Bible tells us that a feast of the Jews was nigh, which is Passover. And yet these people are in the mountains so they can be in the presence of Jesus. And it implies that they should have been leaving to go to Jerusalem and observe the Passover. So there is a national holiday as well as a religious holiday that these people are not attending so that they can be with Jesus. In verse 5, the Bible tells us that none of these things kept the crowd away from him. That is, the 4th of July, Yom Kippur, the distance. All these things didn't get in the way, and these people gathered by the multitudes to see Jesus. And here they were, hundreds upon hundreds, in his presence. And it is a success in the sense that these hundreds have gathered because of what they've seen him do and what they anticipate him doing, because they're actually not going to Jerusalem to observe the Passover. And then something very strange occurs, and that is the success that they have creates a problem. Sometimes that happens. The success you have may create an almost insurmountable problem. And that's oftentimes what we are unprepared for. The problems that success creates. If you call this a success in the sense that great crowds gathered, then you would have to say that the gathering of the great crowd created a real serious problem. Jesus, in verse 5, questioned Philip and said, "Whence shall we buy bread that these may eat?" Of course, being in an isolated area, there were no merchants, there was no village near, there was no place to buy bread. So there was a serious problem, and Jesus asked Philip about the circumstances. Where are we going to get bread? Now, these problems that arise out of our successes, our supposed successes, oftentimes become our testing ground. How are you going to solve the problem that success has created? Many people have not thought about the fact that the multitudes that they draw to a place where they claim you can find God have never thought about the fact that they are creating for themselves and for the work of God more problems than they're solving. Now, a huge crowd based upon carnal things might create for us far more serious problems than simply having the kind of attendance that we've begun to have. And you said, Brother Penn, you mean you'd be disappointed if thousands showed up? No, I wouldn't be disappointed. But it might not be a sign of our success if we had turned to carnal things to draw the crowd. And that may have created far more problems for us than we could ever solve. Now, Jesus asked Philip this problem to prove him. And this word means to create a trial. So Jesus saw the circumstances, thousands of people here, no place to buy food, and he asked Philip about it, and the idea is, Philip, what can we do? And this created a trial for Philip. Now Jesus knew what he would do, and he wanted Philip to voice his trust in him. Now Philip could have said, Lord, you will take care of the situation here as you did at Cana. Remember Cana? When the wine ran short? What happened? Who met the problem? Who solved the problem? Was it not Jesus who took the water pots that were used for the courtesy of washing hands and things of that nature, had them pour the water out and then changed this, or had them to fill the water and it changed it into wine? That was at Cana in Galilee, the first miracle the Bible tells us that Jesus did. Now, Andrew, in verse 7, Philip answered him, 200 penny worth of bread is not sufficient for them, that every one of them may take a little. And one of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said unto him, there's a lad here. Now, what you're looking at in verse 7 is that Jesus wanted an affirmation of faith. And Philip gave him an analysis of the problem. Now you think about that statement for a minute. Jesus wanted Philip to say, Lord, I don't know how I would do it, but I know you know how to do it, and I trust you to take care of it because I remember Cana. But instead of that, Philip analyzed the problem. And he said, Lord, 200 penny worth of bread is not enough, that every one of them may take a little. I think Philip may have been an engineer. I'm not sure. But he analyzed the problem real well, ran it through his computer and said, you know, if we had this huge amount of money and we bought this huge amount of bread, why, that wouldn't be enough for everybody to have just a little bit. And then Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, he told Jesus what was available. Now the needs and what was available, there was a huge gap between them. Andrew said, we've got a lad here which has 5 barley loaves and 2 small fishes. Now here's the scene. We need thousands of loaves of bread, and we got what? Five. This almost sounds like business meeting, John. You tell us how much we got, and we know how much we need, and there's a big gap between the things. We know what we got, and we know what we need, but they don't fit together very well. Here was a tremendous need, and here was the available supply, and there's a tremendous difference in them. So the idea is, what can we do now that what is available is not enough to take care of the need? Five barley loaves, two small fishes. And as Andrew said, that's not much. In fact, he issued a philosophical concept that you could almost write books about. Because he said, what are they among so many? You might even change that pronoun and say, what are we among so many? What significance is there in these loaves and fishes that we have the available supply and the pressing need? There is such a difference between these things. I don't understand how they could even have a meaning. And that's what he's saying. You can't even draw a meaning from this vast difference between what we've got and what we need. You just can't say, well, at least we've got five loaves and two fishes. It doesn't even make sense to say that. The need is so widely separated from that which is available. Now, this wasn't a lack of optimism. It wasn't being negative or non-progressive. It was being forgetful. It was an improper estimate of the power of Jesus Christ. Now, facts and figures don't lie. Divide five dinner rolls and two brim so that 5,000 men all get enough to solve what's for dinner and see what you come up with. We got 5,000 hungry men. We got five dinner rolls and two brim. Now, how much will each man get? Now, those are the facts and those are the figures. You're going to come up with a concept that we can't even cut them small enough. It's not going to work. And that's the problem that Jesus presented to his disciples, particularly to Philip, and Andrew then joined in with them. When we face a problem in the Lord's work that seems insurmountable, and we seem to hear Jesus say to us, what are you going to do? Don't quote facts. He knows the facts. Ask him what he wants us to do. You know, did Jesus know that you can't feed 5,000 men with five loaves and two fishes? Did he know that? Did he see the people there? Was Jesus conscious of the problem? I think he was, don't you? Does he know our problem? Does he know how much money you make? Well, you know, most of us have problems with the things we need in life and oftentimes get in some kind of tight financial circumstance. Let me ask you this. Does God know how much you make? Does God know how much you owe? And you say, there's about as much difference between what I make and what I owe as the fishes and the 5,000. I understand that too. What I'm saying is, God doesn't need us to tell him about the problem. He already knows that. There's not a problem that he doesn't know about in my life or your life or the life of this church. He knows the problems. What we need to do is to ask him, what do you want us to do? Do you want us to just sit down? Or do you want us, what is the thing that you want us to do? We don't need to tell him what the problem is. We need to let him tell us how to solve it. Because he knows how. Faith remembers Cana and Galilee. Faith remembers, go thy way, thy son liveth. But we oftentimes forget the message of faith. God's solutions to his problems are seldom predictable. Now you'll notice I said God's solution to his problem, because let me ask you this, whose problem was this? Was it Philip's? Had all these 5,000 plus come out to see Philip? Had they all come to see Andrew? Who was the central character in this problem? Was it not Jesus? So it wasn't Philip's problem. It wasn't Andrew's problem. Whose problem was it? Wasn't it God's? Wasn't it Jesus' problem? You know, this church, if it's what I believe it to be and your hearts are what I believe them to be, whatever problem there is, it isn't our problem. It's God's problem because we're his people. There's no use ulcerating our stomachs over a problem that's not ours. And Jesus knows our problems. God knows our problems. So Jesus took the problem to his disciples to see what they would say, particularly one disciple, and then proceeded to solve the problem, and here's how he solved it. It's rather unique. Here's these 5,000 men. What did he have them do? Well, he told them to sit down, and to sit down comfortably, because the Bible tells us there was much grass there. Jesus didn't make them miserable by letting them sit on rocky soil. There's much grass. You guys sit down. Now, they're the ones that are hungry. Now, this ought to tell us something about the grace of God. Jesus didn't tell them, you guys need to get up and find some way to change this much grass into some good food. Now, we want you to use your ingenuity. We want you to use your training. We want you to get busy. God helps those who help themselves. Ever heard that? Well, how would these people have helped themselves? God is the God of the helpless. Not the smart and the wise. God is the God of the helpless. So God, in order for this thing to work out like he wanted it, Jesus said, now you 5,000 hungry guys, you sit down comfortably here in the grass. And then the Bible tells us that the first thing that Jesus did was offer thanks. That's the best way you can approach any problem you've got. I don't care if it's a health problem, a financial problem, or whatever it is. The first thing you do in solving a problem is to give God thanks. Now, I know that doesn't make a lot of sense, but I think it's the best thing you can do and I can do is say, God, thank you. And while you're doing it, you might think about Cana. He then gave food to his disciples. You know, Jesus didn't distribute this food directly to the 5,000. The first thing he did, he gave thanks, and then he started giving it to his disciples, and his disciples then gave it to the 5,000. There is something for us to do, folk. You know what it is? Give the world what Jesus gives us. Now, Jesus gave the disciples bread and said, give this to the hungry, and that's what they did. Listen, the world is lost without Jesus Christ. People need the truth. They need the truth about baptism, about churches. They need the truth so they can live a successful life for God. Listen, We don't need to invent anything. We just need to give the people what Jesus gave us to give them. And you know what he gave us to give them, don't you? It's this book right here. Now, there was an abundance that was left over. And people have made a lot of issues out of that, and maybe have preached a lot of sermons about it, but I've come up with this concept that I think is true, and that is sometimes God gives too much. Look at the manna in the wilderness. There were huge amounts of it left, but you couldn't gather it in anticipation, except according to the direction of God for the Sabbath. Sometimes God gives too much, and there's an abundance. And sometimes God gives just enough. You ever had that happen? You needed it, and what God gave was it just squeaked in. It was just enough. But I'm going to tell you something. God never gives too little. Okay? He may give too much, or he may give just enough, but I can tell you that God never undersupplies the people who are doing his work. It's always there. Now, the men who received this miraculous feeding, they had a right conclusion. But they took the right information they had and they made a bad application of it. The men who were fed recognized their feeding as a sign. A sign by which anything is designated. They said, "This is of a truth, that prophet that should come into the world." Deuteronomy 18 and 15 and Deuteronomy 18 and 18 tell us that there was the prophecy that a prophet would arise like Moses. And evidently these men believed there was some relationship between the loaves and fishes and the manna that God sent to Moses. And so they're looking at this thing and they're thinking and figuring it out, and they're saying there was Moses, and people who followed him were fed with an incessant, abundant supply of manna. Here is this man who is a prophet of God. Of God who followed Moses, so we will follow him, and there will be an incessant, abundant supply of food for our bellies. They had a lot of good information, made some good conclusions, but they applied the information they had in a bad way. Now, in verse 15, the Bible tells us when Jesus therefore perceived that they would come and take him by force to making a king, he departed again into a mountain unto himself alone. Jesus said he knew their hearts and he knew their intent and he knew their plans. The word that's translated force here means to seize upon and carry off. Actually, it was a kidnapping. And that's what these people, these 5,000 men, intended to do, was to seize him, to kidnap him, and to then make him king of Israel. And again I say, what is wrong with that? You know, people are constantly, when I tell them I don't believe that this million-man march on Washington that's planned by the Promise Keepers, and I tell people, I don't think God's in that. They say, but you've got men who want to keep their promises. Let me tell you about promises. Either don't make them, and that's one thing you need to learn, is God says don't make a lot of promises. Let your conversation be yea and nay. If you make one, keep it. That's simple. But people say, well, here's a man who wants to keep his promises. He wants to keep his family. Why are you discouraging him? Because I'm discouraging him for the same reason that Jesus left these people and wouldn't let them make him king. It wasn't the right way to do it. There's a right way and a wrong way. And, you know, Jesus is going to be king of Israel one of these days. Did you know that? The devil wanted to make him king by saying, if you'll jump, then I'll make you king. And Jesus said, no, because I've got to go by the cross before there's a kingship. And Jesus, here's what he did. He departed again into a mountain himself alone. Now you just back off and measure this thing by the measuring stick of our modern day religionists. And they would have proclaimed this a great victory and asked for money for themselves. And Jesus saw it for what it was. It was a sham, misinterpretation, misapplication. It was a mess. So he just ran off and left while they were trying to kidnap him and make him king. Listen, men aren't going to make Jesus king of this world. He's going to make himself king of this world. You know, you can a bunch of puny, sinful people. Listen, if every human on earth would vote by raising the right hand and saying, we want Jesus to be king, he wouldn't come and be king. Because it's not our decision, brethren. It's God's decision. And here there's a bunch of hypocrites. We want him to be king. Why? So we can eat good. Jesus left them. And I'm going to tell you what. If that's all you want out of God, he'll leave you. You just want a good suit and a good car and a good home and good food. If that's all you want out of God, you got a bad heart toward God.